Blog Talk Radio.
At the end of the Toyota 500, it's the Charlotte line. Boy, we are excited tonight. What a great race. What an interesting finish. Lots of great things happening. So we're going to cover that. This is Dr. John. We've got Zach. How are you up in Studio D tonight, Zach?
I've got popcorn and water. I'm ready to party.
Rock and roll. Uh-oh. Got any extra salt? It's good for you. Brady, how are you doing tonight out there in Des Moines, Iowa? What's going on?
Not a whole lot. Just kind of vibing up here. It's a Wednesday night, NASCAR racing on a prime time, and I got the day off tomorrow. So not really a whole lot to complain about.
You are the lucky man. All right, guys, go to it. What happened tonight? Tell us what went on, even though I know. But, I mean, you know, tell us all what happened. The Toyota 500, and then we got to cover this past weekend, the Heroes race in Florence. So let's go, buddies.
The Heroes race. Well, the big thing was there's two races at Darlington. There were supposed to be three. Xfinity got rained out. That was no surprise. We honestly thought we were going to get a rain out tonight as well. Somehow, and I do mean this, somehow NASCAR got a window. Mother Nature was kind to us and gave us a prime time Wednesday night race. The only other time we get a Wednesday night race is the Eldora Mud Summer Classic and sometimes a Bristol race on a Thursday night. But it's fun to see a race prime time under the lights at Darlington. And I was excited. It was a good strong race. We didn't have such a chaotic start like we did this past Sunday for the Darlington race that re-kicked off the season. We'll talk about that. But Brady, real quick, sum up your thoughts on this race before we hop into Sundays, because we should go in order, I feel.
Oh, it was definitely a good race tonight. And actually, a fun fact, this was the first Cup Series race ran on a Wednesday night since the iconic 1984 Pepsi 400 that Richard Petty won his 200th and final Winston Cup Series race event at. So, really historic night, completely unprecedented. Like Zach said, aside from a couple of random support races and of course, the Eldora Dirt Derby, racing on a weeknight is completely foreign to a NASCAR fan. So there's a little bit of history there for you. But honestly, the race had everything you wanted. It had good side-by-side action, good pit strategy, twists and turns, and a controversial finish. I mean, it's really the makings of everything you want in a given race.
And it's the second race back. Now, interesting thing that is happening is NASCAR is doing – multiple races at one track within a few days. So this past Sunday was the first race that kicked off. We'll talk about that in just a couple moments. But, yeah, it's the last time there was a real race that ran in full that was prime time was actually from a rain delay at, I believe it was 2012. It was 2012 when Juan Pablo Montoya crashed into the jet dryer. There was a massive wreck. That was the first time that I've ever seen a race on primetime television. That was a Monday because it got rained out the day before. That was Danica Patrick wrecked on lap one, taking out Ricky Stenhouse and Jimmy Johnson. That was the whole jet dryer incident. That race was memorable, and I think this one will be too for multiple reasons. One big one, a controversial finish, like you said, and also just how quiet the grandstand was.
Oh, I mean, the grandstands were a freaking ghost town up there. Just not a whole lot going on up there. And I think they did a better job with this race than they did Sunday's race, which we'll talk about here in a minute, of not spending a whole lot of time panning to what the grandstand was doing. I think it's because with the heavy feeling and the rain in the area, they weren't able to get the overhead shots that they were doing on Sunday. But I don't know. Today I felt more invested, like it was an actual race and not an exhibition, because Sunday they kept panning to the grandstands and it was just jarring and taking me out of the experience, as I'm hearing myself in feedback here.
Well, and that's a great point you're making. You know, it does feel different. Even though the race is at the same track, the big difference for me besides the time of day was a lot of the panning action, because they would cut to the grandstand a lot. And when there's no fans, what's the point in doing that besides showing, hey, look, we wish you guys could be here. I mean, that's all that's telling me is we wish you guys were here. But nonetheless, there was still great racing action. lot of lead changes, a lot of domination by one driver, Clint Bowyer, who then wrecked out, who then it went back to Denny Hamlin, and even Kyle Busch, who struggled this past this Sunday race, definitely was a day-night race because that's what it was. Darlington Sunday, day race. Darlington today, tonight, was a night race. And I think that might have played into some people, one of them being Denny Hamlin's, because he's such a great night racer, and he's a great racer at Darlington. He's won multiple times there, both in the Xfinity and in the Cup level.
Oh, yeah, no, Darlington's definitely one of Denny's better tracks. This is actually his third win in the Cup Series and 39th overall in his career. This to be paired up with his Daytona 500 win that he had earlier in the season. So definitely things are definitely turning up all Denny Hamlin, coming off of a successful run where he bookended the Pro Invitational Series for the NASCAR iRacing, winning the opening race at Texas and then winning the finishing race there at North Wilkesboro. So definitely a good year for Denny Hamlin in 2020.
Was it the opening race was at Homestead, I thought.
You're right. I knew it was the opening race, but I couldn't remember what track they went to. But you are correct. Homestead was the opener that he won.
That's because Timmy Hill won at Texas, and that's another thing. Timmy Hill, you know, for the equipment they have, brought the car, which, by the way, they ran the exact same chassis, exact same car, no damage to it from Sunday. They said, screw it, we'll just load it up on the hauler, clean it, and bring it right back. Quite a few teams did that because a lot of the chassis would work well, and some did, some didn't, but that's also racing in different conditions. So, any other thoughts on tonight's race? Feel bad for Chase Elliott, obviously. But other than that, overall, what was your favorite moment from tonight's race? We'll go more in depth on it, I think, later on. But because it just happened, there's so much more we have to take in on it.
Honestly, my biggest takeaway is probably going to be the Chase Elliott incident. I know that's a cop-out. It's the obvious choice. But I feel like that's the incident that's going to have the most repercussions as we go on into the season. Kyle Busch being the polarizing figure that he is, it's definitely going to come back to bite him, I feel like. And Chase, he's kind of a quiet driver, but I don't think he's going to just sit on this all season. I think he's going to do something. And like Kyle said in his post-race interviews, it's personal at this point because Kyle used to run for that team. Alan Gustafson was his crew chief when Kyle first came into the sport around 2005, and he has so many friends on that team that were the old Kellogg's number 5 crew. So they're not just going to take this sitting down.
I'm right there with you with that. And also a big one for me, I think, was seeing Clint Bowyer, who had a great run going for him on Sunday's race, and truly was dominating this race, winning both stages. I think, honestly, he was on track to win and then just got into the wall, cut a tire, and just the end of his night. But that being said, he's still going to party hard. I mean, he got 20 extra points and 2 bonus points for the playoffs.
That's really, really good. And also another story from this, I think he finished like 13th or 14th, but Ryan Newman, he has 2 top 15 finishes in his 2 races since having that life-altering wreck at the Daytona 500 a couple of months ago. So, I mean, that there in itself might be honestly one of the biggest storylines this entire season, no matter what happens going forward, because the recovery that he made and the fact that he was not only able to come back, race without any practice, without any qualifying, without any laps in a car since his crash at Daytona, and not only make it all 700 miles between the two races, but be in the hunt, be consistently in the top 15, and finish respectively at one of the toughest tracks on the NASCAR schedule with 2 top 15 finishes. I mean, you got to give Ryan Newman and that whole crew a big round of applause because that is just a completely unprecedented feat, and it's just mind-boggling what he was able to do.
That is true, and that's a big thing that Brady hit is there's been no practice and no qualifying at these tracks at all. Teams literally show up, unload the car, push it through tech, push it to the line. And that's a big thing. Let's start talking about this past Sunday's race because that's a big one. And you said it, that was actually the big headline that I had, was Ryan Newman coming back to the track after his horrific Daytona 500 with a strong top 15 finish. And some people are like, well, that's not, you know, a great finish. That's a fantastic finish for someone who hadn't been in a car since February, since the 500. We had Ross Chastain who filled in for him, who is not racing the Cup. There was no plan for him to run any of the Cup races. He might be running the 600. I wasn't too sure. It's still up in the air. That is just something else that he is able to, like you said, come back with the top 15 finish on his first start ever since Daytona. Not his first start, his first race back since, you know, what would be Phoenix's last race. No, since Atlanta. And he put on a show. Like he put it on like he never left. Like he had never even left the track at all. He did, however, get a test session at Darlington by NASCAR requirements to clear him for racing. But even then, he still outperformed some amazing people.
And he was just the same old Ryan Newman that we've come to know and love. He was hard to pass. He was fighting for every inch. And so you know damn well that his nerve isn't gone. He is still the same tough-to-pass bastard that he's always going to be. So that, to me, was the most rewarding part because I didn't want that, you know, everything, you know, to take away the Ryan Newman that we've come to know and love because that man owns the track. If you want to get around that six car, you better be bringing a freaking bulldozer because he ain't moving unless you move him out the way.
That is very true. By the way, this was the Real Heroes 400 that we're talking about. And, you know, Ryan Newman started the race off in the 21st position, finishing the top 15 and getting 24 points. That's still that's a big thing for him. His teammate did not have such a great night. Chris Buescher, finishing four laps down, had some issues later on, but still a decent finish for the young man. Him and the 95 had an incident on the front straight, on the front stretch on lap 218. But that's just a strong showing, and I think that's going to show that Newman is someone who will be on the lookout for a championship this year now.
Oh, definitely. There's a long way between now and Homestead, but if this is any indication, I feel like he has not missed a beat, and I'll be glad to see him back in the saddle and competing for that championship. And it's not just Newman that was an impressive comeback story. Matt Kenseth as well. Kenseth hasn't been in a competitive Cup Series ride since the Homestead finale in 2018. And even at that point, he was driving the same number six car that we're talking about with Ryan Newman that was in absolute shambles. That team had no direction, had no real clear-cut way of how to fix that fledgling program. Matt came in for like 12 or so races that season, and even he like got him to like top 10 finishes, but they were by the skin of his teeth at some time. And he's not been in a car since that Homestead finale in 2018. Comes over to a brand new operation, the Chip Ganassi 42. Hasn't even been in a Chevrolet product since 1999, albeit. And never worked with this crew, never been able to meet them in person because of all the COVID restrictions. We can't even go to the shop and, you know, meet with his crew, kind of gel, work on that chemistry, just complete blind. Steps in behind the wheel of this 42 car and manages a top 10 finish in his first outing. Like, I'm still blown away by the 2003 champion's performance on Sunday.
That is true. So Chip Ganassi Racing had let go of Kyle Larson after he used a slur during a non-official iRacing event. And it was weird because they did talk about that. Not about the incident, but they talked about why Kenseth. And people were saying, why not put Ross in there? And Chip said he has bigger plans for Ross Chastain himself. And putting him in this, he wants to win a championship. It was funny, too. On the broadcast, you heard them talk about, you know, Carl Edwards got the call. Who's the next person? Matt Kenseth. Matt Kenseth hasn't been just sitting at home, you know, playing with his daughters, you know, making dollhouses. No, he and his wife are active runners. He ran the New York Marathon, I believe it was. And he's even been doing some short track racing. He raced Ty Majeski, and Ty Majeski is running full-time in the Truck Series for Nice Motorsports. who, if you saw the Daytona truck race, well, within five laps, he was already on his roof. A nice way to get, you know, into the series. But he hasn't slowed down at all. He's still racing, nothing in NASCAR, doing some late model stuff, doing some stuff more for fun. In fact, him and Johnny Sauter and Ty Majeski have all been racing against each other. And that's what Chip wanted. He wanted someone that could win him a championship. And coming out your first start, finishing 10th and battling up there for so long, it shows that Matt's ready to not just race, but to possibly win a championship for Chip Ganassi.
And what I feel like gets lost in the shuffle is a lot of people like point to his last win with Joe Gibbs Racing, the penultimate race of 2017. He won at Phoenix, and that was a really good high note to leave on. But honestly, even though it's kind of overlooked, he ended his tenure with the number six car in 2018 on a fairly high note. He had back-to-back top 10 finishes in his last two outings with that team, a seventh at Phoenix and an eighth at Homestead. And like I said before, just a little bit ago, that six car was absolutely hemorrhaging. It just was not competitive at all. Trevor Bayne, no fault to him, like the whole program itself was just in a backslide for most of the later parts of the 2010s. And by that point in 2018, the six car was completely out of gas. There was no direction. Trevor Bayne was not able to really give the team the feedback they were needing to fix the problem. The 17 car, the sporting car, was also not performing well. It was just a really bad situation. And Ken's first outing with that team in Kansas of 2018, he finished 36th. You got to talk about a hell of a turnaround in the team to go from 36th and over a span of 12 races, be finishing top 10 in consecutive races. Like, that just speaks to the caliber of driver that Matt Kenseth is. Wherever he goes, he builds a program up around him because he not only is a good driver, but he understands the technical side of it too. He will give you feedback that will be so invaluable, and it's just based off of years of knowledge and working on cars. And that's why you need a driver like Matt Kenseth to come into the ride like the 42, a team that has no direction. Their star driver, the driver that Chip Ganassi has literally been building an entire program around since 2014, gone in an instant. Where do you go? Like, your whole compass is completely thrown off. Like, you have no direction at that point. And that's why you couldn't give the keys to a guy like Ross Chastain. You know, politics, driver contracts aside, like, Ross Chastain was not what this team needed at this time. They needed a veteran presence like Matt Kenseth to come in and to start giving them feedback, giving them that knowledge, because even though Chip Ganassi has had success with Kyle Larson, they've struggled with the Chevy Camaro. Like, since 2018, when they introduced the Camaro body style, the 42 program has completely fallen off the map. They went from a four-win season, middling in the back of the pack, and a no-win season in 2018, you know. So they really need this right now. And you pair them up with Kurt Busch, two of the best drivers to ever strap into Jack Roush equipment. You got yourself the making of a 1-2 dynasty that we've not seen the likes of since Talladega Nights. I'm just telling you right there.
And that's a great point. And these two, and Chip Ganassi's other driver in the sport is a former teammate of Matt Kenseth. Both Kurt Busch and Matt Kenseth were teammates at Jack Roush Racing. They won back-to-back championships. Kurt Busch first, then Matt Kenseth. And you're right. But they combined, I think, won 23 races combined for Jack Roush. And it's astonishing to have them back together. And by the way, Kurt Busch bringing home a third-place finish for the team. That's the only organization in the first race of this year, or the first race since the season has restarted, to have all their cars in the top 10. Now, it's only two cars, but still, to have both your cars finish the top 10 when all the others maybe had two, like Stuart Haas only had one, and that was the win. Hendrick Motorsports had two. Joe Gibbs Racing had two. Having your whole team, you know, not that bad.
Honestly, yeah. And of all tracks to do it at, like, we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but I could not think of a harder track for NASCAR to come back to. I mean, honestly, logistically, travel-wise, it was the obvious pick. It's super close to home. The sanctions are pretty lax in South Carolina with everything going on. It was the ideal choice. But to come out 2 months off, no practice, no qualifying. I could not think of a more terrifying track to come back to. It's just so odd. The shape of it is completely off. You have to completely run both ends of the track completely different because there's no symmetry there. And you're running up against the wall because the groove is so razor thin. And then you throw in guys like Matt Kenseth and Ryan Newman who are trying to make their comeback. But then you throw in a smattering of rookies, you know, Cole Custer, Christopher Bell, Tyler Reddick, John Hunter Nemechek, all these young guns that while they may have been making a lot of noise in the Truck Series and Xfinity Series, these drivers were making their very first Cup Series laps at Darlington under the green flag. I could not imagine just the anxiety and the pressure that those drivers were under, those rookies. You know, because Darlington is scary enough when you have practice and qualifying to kind of get yourself prepped up. But to go in there completely blind, like, I got to tip my hat, especially to Tyler Reddick and John Hunter Nemechek. Reddick managed a seventh-place finish, and John Hunter Nemechek a ninth-place finish. Like, those are two staggering results that is just unheard of in normal circumstances that you come to Darlington in your first try in a Cup Series ride and get a top 10. But to go in under these extenuating circumstances with no practice or anything, like, it's just mind-boggling. And the only other time that I can think of that's even remotely close to this was 2009 when an unnamed rookie named Joey Logano, like, he never went on to do anything, right? But he came in, and he was having a pretty shit season, let's be completely honest, in 2009. Comes into Darlington, one of the toughest tracks, keeps the car clean, comes home with a top 10 finish. And I'm sitting there, you know, 2009 at this point, like 15 years old, like, who is this Joey Logano kid? Like, he ain't nothing. He's not earned his teeth. But he whooped Darlington, so, you know, maybe he might be a hot prospect. And sure enough, by the end of the decade, he's a champion of the sport, won the Daytona 500. So, honestly, you got to keep your eyes on those two kids because they definitely proved their mettle. And you got to look at John Hunter Nemechek even closer because – he's running for Front Wheel Motorsports. That's a team that, while they have decent equipment, they're a B-class team at best, you know, because they just don't have the resources that a Hendrick or a Stuart Haas or a Chip Ganassi has. And he took that 38 on his back and muscled it to a ninth-place finish. Like, I'm just flabbergasted, and he has my respect because that is a hell of an outstanding performance for John Hunter Nemechek. And he started 34th. Drove up there.
And that's a great point. You know, for rookies, you know, there's, like you said, there's quite a few rookies. Gwynn Hoff is the only rookie that's never ran at Darlington, period. The rest of these guys have run Xfinity there. But that's a great point. John Hunter Nemechek and Tyler Reddick both getting their career best finishes, period, at Darlington. Both of them never ran there before and never got any practice laps. Their first practice laps were the first 25 laps, or was it 35 laps before the competition caution. And even then, they were doing pretty well, and that's a big thing for them. You know, you talk about first-time outing. Another team that had one was Cole Custer for Stuart Haas Racing. By the way, Stuart Haas brought home the win with Kevin Harvick winning, leading 159 laps, the most of anyone, and his first win for the season and the first win for Stuart Haas for this year as well. Cole Custer bringing home 22nd. That's not too bad. Again, for a kid who has only run, I believe before the season started, only ran three Cup races. Two of them were actual races he started. One was a relief for Austin Dillon at Fontana. Finishing 22nd with a car that wasn't too tore up, not that bad. The other two cars, Eric Almirola finishing 5th, or 12th, I'm sorry, and Clint Bowyer finishing 17th. But Cole Custer, I think that's a pretty good finish. He didn't have such a great race tonight getting into the wall, but as a rookie, you're bound to do that at just about every track, and a track that we're going to go to three times this year. This is great practice for all of them.
And honestly, you know, you talk about Cole Custer. I've been watching his season so far, and it feels so much like being back in 2017, watching his first season in the Xfinity Series.
Yep.
Not flashy, not super great, not setting the world on fire, but consistent. And that's what I love about Cole Custer as a driver. Like, he knows the limits of what his experience is. He knows the limits of his car, and he just – he just doesn't outrun what he's capable of running on any given night, and that's what's led him to be so successful. He lets the race come to him. He lets his career come to him. And when it all comes together and he's hitting on all his cylinders and the stars align, you better be looking out, because there is no one more just on the wheel, aggressive, and just calculated than Cole Custer. I mean, those, what was it, 7, 8 wins he got last year in the Xfinity Series? And every one of them was just a dominating performance. Not just I won this race, that's cool. He just flat up whooped the field in all those wins last year. And that is what I'm keeping my eye on. Because him and Christopher Bell, they both have had very quiet seasons so far in the Cup Series. Not really set the world on fire, you know, not really done anything spectacular. But they've been consistent. Quiet and consistent. And those are the guys that you got to keep your eye on, because they're the ones that come out of nowhere and surprise you when they start reeling off like 6 wins in a season. And then they become your champion before you even know it. So you got to tip your hat, especially with a driver like Christopher Bell. He's not in the same situation that Cole Custer finds himself in, or even Tyler Reddick. Reddick and Custer are driving for 2 well-established Cup Series teams, 2 teams that have won Cup Series championships, multiple Cup Series championships, and they know what it takes to win on a given Sunday. Christopher Bell, on the other hand, while he's, you know, getting the benefit of a technical alliance, quote-unquote, with Joe Gibbs Racing, this is a very, very new team, very green team. It's not used to running at the front of the pack, and it's just a completely different situation than he found himself in. Granted, he's making the most of the situation, but he's definitely at a higher, you know, uphill climb than the other two drivers have found themselves, but he's doing the best he can with what the situation is given.
That's very true. Christopher Bell himself finishing 24th, which is respectful for the Levine family racing. You know, they've had their ups and downs throughout the years. You know, I've been a long-time fan of them because they had Michael McDowell for many of years, even full-time seasons. And Michael's done a lot of things for them. And then they had Casey Kane for a majority of the season until he was unable to race due to medical issues. Then Regan Smith finished off that season. The next driver, who else would it be other than Matthew Benedetto, who got them their best career finish of a second at Bristol, almost getting his first win. And now they got Christopher Bell. I think the biggest difference, though, now with this team is they have a pure rookie, a rookie that's never ran a cup race, running cup full-time with an uncertainty amount of if he's going to run any Xfinity or even truck races. So it is interesting to see, you know, his progression in the Cup Series. You know, he's ran, like you said, quiet. Him and Cole are running very quiet, and they ran, you know, Cole Custer only finishing 2 spots ahead of him. I think Cole is going to be a little better off this season because he is going to have, you know, he has more teammates to rely on as well. Not only does he have, you know, Kevin Harvick of wisdom, you know, the wisdom he has winning 50 races. He has Clint Bowyer, and as well as, oh, God, I'm brain farting. Who is his other teammate? Oh, my brain stopped working. Help me out here.
You got Clint Bowyer, Eric Almirola, and Kevin Harvick are the other. There you go.
Almirola. My brain stopped working. I was like, you know, and all those guys are winners. You do have the champion of Kevin Harvick. So, you know, I think he's a little better off. And he's also been working with the organization a lot longer. He's been with Stuart Haas, you know, ever since he started his Xfinity career full time. So I have a good feeling Cole is going to do a lot better than Christopher Bell is, just because of the fact of that main alliance, you know, with all his other teammates. But I feel Bell also is going to have a really good season. And, you know, a 24th place finish at a track he's never raced at for a rookie is great. Obviously not as good as, you know, as John Nemechek in a 9th place finish, but still, it's really good. I think another big one to look out, you know, another thing that happened this, or another team that had a really great run was Hendrick Motorsports. They had 2 finishes in the top 5. Alex Bowman, who actually led no laps, finished 2nd. No, he led 41 laps, I'm sorry. And then Chase Elliott finishing 4th. And then you had William Byron and Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy Johnson was on his way to win stage one, where just a little misjudgment got contact with Chris Buescher and just lost it. You know, he could have won the stage. He hit head on into the safe barrier, luckily got out. And he even said himself, you know what? Mistakes were made, nothing crazy, no hard feelings towards anyone. Very professional. William Byron made contact with the wall and then went three laps down and just couldn't really get it back. But then he had a better race tonight. But that's a key thing that happened was Alex Bowman, who signed a contract extension just days before this race, and Chase Elliott finishing in the top five.
And honestly, I couldn't think of a better way for Alex Bowman to make a statement, because the fact that he only got a one-year extension to me is the most appalling, audacious thing I think I've seen. Because aside from Chase Elliott, obviously the Hendrick Golden Boy, that the one they're building this whole program around, the next Jimmy Johnson, yada, yada, blah, 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 Alex Bowman is the only driver to win for that organization since 2017 that's not named Chase Elliott. And he's the only Hendrick driver to win this year. And the fact that he can only manage a one-year contract extension is just appalling to me, because that completely is a slap in the face to the talent that he has and what he's bringing to this crew. Granted, asterisk there, I can't be too hard on William Byron, because he is in the ever-shadowing fourth Hendrick car, the fourth Hendrick car that since the late 90s has been the weakest link of the entire program. So, you know, I can't be too harsh on my boy Billy B, because him and Chad Knauss are literally rebuilding a dead program, a program that has been the ball and chain keeping Hendrick Motorsports back. So I can't be too harsh on Billy B, but, I mean, come on. Alex Bowman is literally busting his ass week in and week out and performing more times than not way better than his other three teammates. And he can only manage another one-year contract extension. That's just – it doesn't make sense to me. Granted, I don't know what the future of Hendrick looks like, because we haven't talked about it yet, but Jimmy Johnson, despite of all the COVID craziness, despite of everything going on, he is maintaining that he is still planning on retiring at the end of 2020. Come hell or high water, no matter what life deals, this is going to be his last season. So that's going to leave a very vacant, open number 48. Right, so Hendrick already has their hands full, you know, trying to pick out who's going to be the heir apparent to honestly one of the biggest, most iconic teams in all of motorsports, especially NASCAR. But you're going to try and, you know, play this him-hawing game of maybe having to fill the 88 car as well? I mean, get out of here with that crap.
Well, I will say this. William Byron did finish 12th today. So, you know, he is at least – he is improving. I feel the darling, the race on Sunday, that was something, and you know, it is something that William is he's a great, it's not that he's not a great driver, proving himself, winning races in truck, Xfinity, and winning championships. It just was one of those hard things. And by the way, he led three laps in Sunday's race and was having a pretty good day until he just had the misfortune of getting into the wall and having a car that he couldn't keep up in the front. But with that being said, the whole thing with Alex Bowman not having a 1 year contract extension, him coming out like this was definitely a showing force. And by the way, he was a strong force again tonight, was up there a lot of the time. He was fighting really hard with everyone. He did fall back to 18th. But if this – I honestly think if the rain had not come, I think Bowman would have been in the top five again, if not maybe even contending for a win, because he was on the lead lap. He went and got tires. Then we had the last caution, and he just could not – he just couldn't move back up.
And that's the thing we're going to have to talk about with this race tonight. There were so many strategies that were set up. There were so many different ways this race could have panned out. And Mother Nature came in. She's like, nope, this is all you get.
Nope.
Which, to be completely honest, I mean, this is way more than I expected for when I woke up, because I was seeing the weather reports all day. I was looking at Twitter, and I was not optimistic. You and I talked this afternoon. I straight up told you. You have the text to prove it. I was like, we ain't going racing tonight. I was proven wrong, and I'm glad I did. But you point out a good performance there. Like, I really thought Bowman showed a lot more strength tonight than his car was ever capable of. But a performance that we've not really talked about in either race, how about my boy Matty DiBenedetto?
14th
on Sunday and a solid top 10 tonight, a ninth place finish. And this is why where I'm segueing here. He and Denny Hamlin were the only two drivers that stayed out on that final caution, which came out with 35 laps to go, that set up this whole big restart that came to a head with this big controversy with Kyle Busch and Chase Elliott. DiBenedetto and Denny Hamlin, they rolled the dice. Hamlin ended up in victory lane. DiBenedetto with the top 10. And I got to say, I'm thoroughly impressed week in and week out with DiBenedetto. His ability to stay cool, keep putting on good performances, racking in the good, solid finishes, and just earning, in what is my mind, the most coveted and special, you know, spot in all of NASCAR. Because the Wood Brothers Racing Team, I don't think they get enough praise for just how amazing that team is. Going through 6+ decades of racing, you know, not letting outside forces come in. They have been a family-owned operation since the beginning, and they decided, you know, they made the hard decision in the 2000s that they decided it was better to be running part-time than to stray away from the family tradition. And that, to me, is why the Wood Brothers Racing Team is one of the greatest dynasties the sport has ever seen, because they have put loyalty and family first, and it has paid off immensely. They have been given a second life in the sport. They're basically a Penske car run out of their family-owned Virginia shop, and they've got just an unbelievably talented and charismatic and just a good, visible representation of that whole team. Like, Matt DiBenedetto literally is the embodiment of the Wood Brothers Racing ethic. He came from nothing, paid his dues, you know, he earned that spot. And for a team that has been earning their way every step of the way, I could not think of a better combination. And I'm just tickled to death to see them week in and week out competing for top 15, top 10s, top 5. And he even got close to a win there before we got, you know, put in quarantine. So I fully expect that by some point, you know, in this crazy world we're in where we're running 3 races a week, that DiBenedetto, he might sneak in and grab him a W, and I could not think of a more deserving win.
Well, that's a great point. And just the list of drivers that have raced for the Wood Brothers range from A.J. Foyt, you know, just a marvelous man, getting them their first win in their first official, and this is the truth, the first ever official Daytona 500 that they entered the 21 car in 1972. David Pearson, Neil Bonnet, Buddy Baker, Kyle Petty, Dale Jarrett, Morgan Shepherd, Michael Waltrip, Elliott Tyler, Ricky Rudd, Ken Schrader. I mean, you just go down the list, and there's so many amazing drivers that have had the opportunity to race for them and get them wins, including multiple Daytona 500s. And Matt is one of those guys that I honestly think will get them their 100th win. They are only at 99 cup wins, period. They're not at 100. For a team that's been around for 6 decades, they have not hit that 100 race win mark just yet, but they are close, and I feel Matt could be the first driver to be the driver to that. I shouldn't say first driver, because then they would be at 100, but and that's a great point. I feel Matt's performance today and on Sunday were great. Some people think a top 14 finish, that's not that good. When you look at the scenario that we've been in and what Matt's capable of, I feel that's a strong indication that he is someone that needs to be in these top-tier equipments. He's proven himself racing for very small teams, racing for start and parks teams, racing and moving up and making decisions. He was in the 32. He left because he was uncertain that, you know, he didn't want to just do it for a paycheck. He wanted to go out there and win. Got the opportunity from Levine for a one-year contract. The week he found out he would not be returning, he almost got his first win, but Denny Hamlin just was a little too quick. Now he's in the iconic Wood Brothers 21. Another driver who was in that was Ryan Blaney, who got them their 99th win at Pocono. So that's just something to show that he's not just a driving force, but he's going to be someone that will be, I think, someone to contend for a championship. Maybe not this year. If he can get a second year with him, which I think he will, I think the next year he will be a contending force for a championship.
And the thing I like about Matt DiBenedetto is he's the kind of driver that I look for, the kind of driver that will go into any team, any situation, and elevate the program around him. You don't want some driver that's going in there, you know, half-cocked and saying, oh, I'm the talent, the driving force behind this. Literally, you build the cars and I'll make it go. You want someone that's going to build a program around them. You think about the 32 team, that go-fast team that he drove for many years. That was a completely kind of off-the-cliff team. And then he brought them out of obscurity, and now they're actually semi-competitive, and Corey LaJoie right now is reaping the benefits of that. He went to the 95 team. He got two, not, you know, like fluke deal, but two hard-earned top fives of that team. And he came in the year after Casey Kane. Casey Kane, a driver with multiple wins, you know, at one time guaranteed as the next Jeff Gordon, guaranteed as the next multi-time champion. He came in a season after Casey Kane and did better, elevated that program around him. And that is what has made me so excited about his pairing with the Wood Brothers, is he's going to take what's been a pretty good team, all things considered, since 2016, since they brought in Ryan Blaney, since they made the Penske deal. Penske has really turned that program around and brought the Wood Brothers up to a point of relevancy not seen, honestly, since the 80s, completely, to be completely honest. And you mix that with a driver like Matt DiBenedetto, work to wherever he goes, the program is better because of it. That is why there is no question in my mind that with the right circumstances, the right car, and the right day, Matt DiBenedetto is going to be a winner before 2020 is out, because he is the kind of driver that elevates those around him. And the Wood Brothers, they have the knowledge. They can put together a car that is capable of winning. And if you give them the right scenario, I'm so certain he will find his way to victory lane, because that combination is just so strong. And it can only get stronger as more time, repetition, familiarity, and that chemistry grows between him, his crew chief, and the whole entire crew as a general.
Well, the big thing, too, is that they have the alliance with Penske. And that's, to put it to you this way, too, the only Penske car that finished better than 14th was Brad Keselowski, who led 80 laps but finished 13th, only one spot ahead. Ryan Blaney finished 16th. Joey Logano finished 18th. That wasn't those are great finishes. But when you think of Team Penske, you don't think of them as just a plain top 20 team. You think of them top 10 or competing for the win. Brad Keselowski was up there and was competing for, you know, leading laps. But falling back to, you know, outside the top 10, like no Penske driver finished in the top 10. That's crazy to me. That did change because they did finish in the top 10 today, obviously, in the race. We had Joey Logano and Brad Keselowski finishing, Brad Keselowski finishing fourth, Joey Logano finishing sixth, and then way back in 21st was Ryan Blaney. Again, I think that was just a bad pit, just bad call because of rain. But Penske as a whole in the first race, loading cars, not knowing what was going to happen, no practice, no nothing, kept having to make adjustments like a lot of these teams, but just couldn't get it figured out for the last run. And even though, you know, the cars came back clean and in the top 20, I felt Roger was like, okay, what do we need to do to make this better for Wednesday's race?
And, you know, it's not to keep beating on the Wood Brothers drum. The thing I love about that team in general, what I think separates them from, honestly, the only other team that you could compare them to, which would be the Petties, is loyalty. When the Petty Enterprises were at their height, you know, they were literally kicking everyone's tail with the Plymouth power, that Dodge Chrysler power. But the moment that Dodge Chrysler lost their edge and they started flipping, Petty was out of there. He's like, well, these guys ain't competitive. Where's that slick Ford Torino? Oh, Ford Torino's not competitive. Where's that Chevy? And so on and so forth. But you look at the Wood Brothers, though. They started with Fords. They stuck with Ford. And that relationship, that loyalty, is why you see Wood Brothers Racing out there competing week in and week out, and you don't see Petty Enterprises out there competing. Petty Enterprises, they turned their back on what made them successful, and it bit them in the ass. They eventually fell off the face of the earth, and they had to close their iconic family-owned doors. I mean, Richard Petty himself left the family-owned team in the 80s at the top of their prime, and the team never recovered. You did not see a single Wood brother leave that Virginia shop. Even at their darkest days when they were missing races in the mid-2000s, John and Eddie and Lynn, they stayed with the team. And that loyalty is why you see Wood Brothers Racing up there in the top 15, top 10, getting good deals, because Ford recognized that loyalty and rewarded that loyalty. Petty, they're like, well, we were the champions. We got to do whatever it takes to be champions. Loyalty be damned. And now they're just a former shell of themselves after a failed merger with Gillette Evernham Motorsports. And I don't care who that pisses off. That's my opinion on the situation, and that is why you see Wood Brothers Racing out there still making it in the 20th century, and Petty is kind of a forgotten name.
Oof. Ooh. He was preaching. I could feel that from here, and I'm like 1,400 miles away. I'll tell you this.
I heard that there, minister's wife, because I'll be preaching from that pulpit.
I'll tell you this. You are right. They did not leave the Ford camp. They did start with Mercury, went to Ford, went back to Mercury, went back to Ford, but that is Mercury is owned by Ford. They still are to this day. So, you know, you are correct on that. So, that's a great point you make. You know, Ford, and it's not just that. It's also Roger Penske. Roger Penske is an icon in just racing. It doesn't matter what kind of racing, rally car, he might have done some rally car stuff, F1, IndyCar. Australian V8 supercars. He owns a team. NASCAR. You say Roger Penske. You could be in Indianapolis. You could be in Monaco. You could be in Sydney, Australia. You say his name, more than likely someone knows him for a race. And for the support that the captain is giving them, because he loves them, you know, it's one of these brotherly loves of also competition. And you know, by the way, they all the Penske cars, including Matt, because it is that Alliance stuff, all finished in the top 20, which is a great run for them. And it just shows that the competitiveness is still there. And it's not like they're going to be hiding some stuff. It's not like, oh, you can maybe get this. No, they are full forge letting the Wood brothers have at it, because they want to show, like, hey, we want you guys to win races too. We want you to get to that magic 100 race win.
And there are multiple interviews where Fred Ford II or whatever we're up to now, the current owner of the Fords, he talked in an interview about, like, how it's not just him. Like, it's a fucking generation passed on. You know, it's the Wood brothers and the Fords. Like, they have been such a close family ties, and that loyalty is what got the Wood brothers to where they are today. Because they stood by that manufacturer, even when Ford was, you know, far behind the Oldsmobiles, the Chevys, the Pontiacs. They stuck by what got them to that point, and that is what has rewarded them with where they're at today. Because if you look at, you know, going back to my comparison, you know, Petty versus Wood Brothers, the last three major Wood Brothers wins, they weren't fluky. I mean, you can say that Trevor Bayne winning the Daytona 500 was a fluke all you want. But if you watch that race and watch how Trevor, you know, navigated, he had a race-winning car, and he took a race-winning car to victory lane, plain and simple. Elliott Sadler at Bristol, he took a race-winning car and earned a race win. Ryan Blaney took a race-winning car and earned a win. Eric Almirola, he's the last driver in two decades to win for the King Richard Petty in the 43. He took an okay car, avoided half the field getting wrecked out, and won in a rain-shortened event. Not to dock Eric Almirola, he's a fantastic driver, but he got handed a win due to circumstance. Like, I don't care. Like, Richard Petty's equipment has completely fallen off because they lost track of what made them great, and that loyalty is what got the Wood Brothers where they're at today, and where Richard Petty has kind of fallen off the map.
I think one team we need to talk about that might have had a little bit of a fall off is, well, Joe Gibbs Racing. They had a great run on Sunday, having having three of their four drivers finish in the top 10. Martin Truex or Denny Hamlin having the best finish of fifth, and he did win the race today. Martin Truex Jr. finishing sixth. Eric Jones finishing eighth, who has won at Darlington before, as well, actually getting his first career second career win ever at Darlington. And then Kyle Busch just, well, he didn't have the day start off well, period, being sent to the back, losing his fourth place starting position, and then just going to get it back. Just had some issues and finished 26th and then finishing second today. So he kind of rebounded, but still Penske hit it off. You know, if he was a V8, he had six of the eight cylinders hitting it off for the day on Sunday.
No, I definitely agree with you. I wouldn't say Jogan's racing as a whole struggle, because if you look at Sunday's race, Denny Hamlin and Eric Jones managed a top 10 finish. And if you look at tonight's race, Denny Hamlin won and Eric Jones also finished top 10. But definitely Kyle Busch was kind of a head scratcher. I knew he would have his work cut out for him on Sunday when he got sent to the back due to that penalty. And I knew with Darlington being the track that it is and how hard it is to pass, that he'd have a hard time, but I didn't expect him to have that hard of a time coming up through the field. And it was just, honestly, was just a horrible race for him. And he got the finish that I feel like he deserved. But tonight, you know, he showed a little more competitiveness. He was definitely flirting around the top 10 a little more. Granted, that second place finish, I feel like was given to him by good pit strategy, but I feel like he had a lot better performance. But I feel like the 18 team itself, and especially the 19 team, the Truex team, I don't know what has happened to that team this year, but it's been a little bit down, but I wouldn't say the whole program of Joe Gibbs Racing is down, because Denny Hamlin and Eric Jones have definitely been kind of carrying that torch, I feel like, this season. And Truex, while he's not had the results to show for it, he's been very competitive, and actually tonight – and Sunday were his first two top tens of the season. So he's finally gotten the results to show for it. So I feel like Joe Gibbs is fine. But, yeah, definitely a curious case of the Kyle Busch I'm noticing here with our comeback.
Well, I guess I should explain a little more. So when they unloaded those cars, Denny Hamlin was really the one car that right off the bat was really good. It was really, he was really steady. He was making great progression. You know, stay up there in the top ten of the race, but Eric Jones kind of struggled a little bit. But the two that struggled the most really was Martin Truex Jr. and they kept making changes to get him that sixth place finish, and Kyle Busch's car just never could get the momentum. He had a couple of scrapes at the wall, but still, even after that, it was just like that wasn't a Kyle Busch, you know, car. And if there's any interviews or anything out there that would show him, you know, his frustration through the mask, I guarantee it wasn't too happy. And it wasn't because his team wasn't doing anything. It was the car just wasn't performing. And I feel like that's what it's kind of been. I think for at least Martin Truex Jr., it's the big problem is he's got a brand new crew chief. You know, Cole Pern left the sport to go run a ski resort for some reason. All right, don't blame him. But now he's got a new crew chief who is having to learn a lot of stuff. So I think that with at least with Martin Truex Jr., that one's explainable. Also, we're six races in now. He's made great progression from that. Kyle, up until tonight, I would say it's hard to tell what's really going on. Is he having issues? Is he getting too old for the sport? He probably kicked
a rightful age of 35.
But with
Truex, I feel like his results aren't indicative, because, you know, Jimmy Small, he's in a tough situation. He's with obviously a championship caliber driver with Truex. He came off a fantastic season in his freshman year with Joe Gibbs. But he's had good races so far in 2020, but the results just aren't there, because whether it be a miscue on pit road, a crash not of his making, his top 10 runs and maybe even race-winning runs have been completely undone by circumstances out of their control. So I feel like they get a pass. But, no, you're onto something there. The Kyle Busch that we've come to know and love, the Kyle Busch that stormed to a 2019 championship, he's, he's not quite been there this year in 2020. He's kind of middling and kind of struggling, which is, we're not used to that from old Rowdy.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder if maybe Kyle might be focusing too much on getting wins in other series. And what I mean by that is, if you think about it, he's quoted this saying, once I hit 100 wins in each series, I'm done. I'm retiring. He's only, I think, 3 or 4 races away from winning 100 races in the Xfinity series. He's still quite a ways away, almost 40 races in the truck. I wonder if that might be something that's, driving his focus away. We've seen Jeff Gordon had never, hardly ever ran an Xfinity race or a truck race. He never ran a truck race, but he's never ran, a lot of Xfinity or lower-tier races. I don't know. I think one thing for him is he needs to be more focused on this, and people need, and he needs to maybe not think so much of Xfinity or truck, and maybe his racing will get better for the rest of the year.
See, I don't think that's true, because I look, the one season that sticks out in my mind where this whole theory was put to the test was 2012. That season, he really, up to this point for Kyle Busch standards, he really scaled back his involvement in the Truck Series and Xfinity Series, and he went winless that entire year in Xfinity Series. He didn't run Joe Gibbs racing equipment. He ran his own equipment that year, and he didn't get a win that whole season. And on the Cup Series side of things, he got maybe 1 or 2 wins, but he completely fell off the map. It was just completely bizarre. So I don't think it's quite that per se, because I feel like a driver like Kyle Busch, he needs to be constantly driving. He needs to be constantly behind the wheel of something and pushing himself to the limit, because he is an absolute competition junkie. He feeds not on the actual race itself, but on the competition. He thrives on the competition. I feel like it's more really a problem with Toyota as a whole. Because up until this point, with the introduction of the Camaro in 2018, Toyota and Ford have really been kind of just dominating the sport, just been kind of passing trophies back and forth between the two of them and letting Chevy, whenever they beg hard enough, get a trophy or two, every now and then. But this year, Chevy introduced that new Camaro ZL1 whatever body style that really rounded off the nose, and I really feel like picked up their own performance. And with Chevy kind of taking it more to Ford week in and week out, Toyota's really fallen behind. So I feel like it might be more of a manufacturer problem than an actual Kyle Busch problem. Because if you look at his 2020 stats, 34th at Daytona, but Daytona's a crapshoot. 15th at Las Vegas is bad, but he's never really been a super great driver at his home track. But then you've got a 2nd at California, 3rd at Phoenix, 20th at Darlington, meh. But then a 2nd place tonight. So I feel like the performance is still there, but I feel like Toyota as a whole is kind of struggling a little bit this year, and they've kind of become, quote-unquote, the third-place manufacturer behind Ford and Chevy, because Chevy came out of nowhere and found a whole lot of speed that they've been missing the last 2 years.
I get you. I feel where you're coming from. That's definitely something, too. And I think we need, it's still early on in the season, even though technically we would be about 12 races into the year. We're only 5. We're only 6 now. We're 6 races in. We got some makeup to do. That being said, we're getting close. I think we need to be ready. We need to be ready because we have the Coca-Cola 600, the big one, the biggest race of the year for us, because it's the longest. It's 600 miles. It's going to be quiet because there aren't going to be fans, but it's still going to be a great racing action. And we also have Truck Series racing. We have Xfinity racing tomorrow at Darlington because that got rained out. And we also have another Cup Series race at Charlotte. And I feel like I'm missing – oh, and we also have one or two more Xfinity races.
So we got coming up on the docket, we got the Xfinity race tomorrow – the Coke 600 on Sunday, then the Xfinity race on Monday, Truck Series race on Tuesday at Charlotte, and then we wrap it up with another Charlotte Cup Series race before going into a completely expanded schedule. NASCAR has announced races past the Charlotte Motor Speedway weekend, starting Saturday, May 30th, with the Bristol Xfinity race, and then Sunday, May 31st, Bristol for the Cup Series action, that in Tennessee. Then the weekend of June 6th, we move on to Atlanta, Georgia, with the Truck Series and Xfinity Series doing a doubleheader action on Saturday, June 6th, Cup Series on Sunday, June 7th. We move on to the Virginia track of Martinsville for a Wednesday night short track primetime action for the Cup Series race, June 10th. Then we go to Homestead, Miami, Florida for the Trucks on Saturday, June 13th, followed by the Xfinity Series Saturday, June 13th, Xfinity Series on June 14th, Sunday, Cup Series June 14th on the Sunday. We take a few days off. Then we go to Talladega, Alabama for the Saturday, June 20th race for the ARCA Series, Saturday, June 20th for the Xfinity Series, and then we wrap it all up with the Cup Series on Sunday, June 21st.
What an incredible list of racing, man. I tell you what.
I know. Where you've been all night. I've been meaning to ask you your thoughts on Myrtle Beach. We missed last week's race, and I was so bummed because I wanted to ask you your thoughts on that.
Which thoughts? I got a lot of thoughts
on Myrtle Beach. They're shutting down the Speedway.
Right. Well, we covered that a couple of weeks ago. And
we weren't sure just yet, but they've made the formal announcement now.
Well, we were actually sure of it down here because we knew that they were going to get zoning permission to do what they were going to do, and it's just a shame. And I need to try to have somebody from the Myrtle Beach Speedway to come on and talk with us. I think that'd be a good thing. I've got a couple of guys that I know, so we'll see if we can't have them here in the next couple of weeks just to talk about it and the great history of Myrtle Beach. Myrtle Beach is a pretty good place. It really is. It's done me well. So anyway, I just wanted to say it's been great with our, you know, with coronavirus and everything. We had to do a little bit of rescheduling here, but we've had a great night tonight because it's, tell you what, it's pretty close to midnight, and we're going to be back next week, Tuesday night, regular time, regular place, regular hour, regular minute, 10 p.m. Eastern time next Tuesday night on the Charlotte Line. So, guys, it's been great having you. It's been a lot of fun. I've just enjoyed listening to everything and enjoying it. So, are we ready for next? Are we going to be ready for next week? Brady, you going to be here?
Time will tell.
I might have pants on.
Okay.
All right then.
All right, Zach, you're going to be here too?
As far as I can tell, I should have pants on, and I will be ready to talk more racing action. And I might have something in the works to possibly even go to Virginia for a race. Might.
Oh, maybe. Well, that sounds cool.
Maybe. It all depends on what the governor says.
Oh, gotcha. Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you guys, and we'll see everybody next week, right, on the Charlotte Line, 10 p.m., Tuesday night. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, the slow, agonizing pain.